Thank you, Sue and worship team. It's one of those times where you feel like we could call it good right now, and it would have been a great time together this morning. We're ready to dismiss Discovery Clubs, the younger and the older. We've all heard the phrase that timing is everything. So many things seem to depend upon timing, don't they? We can think of events in life when our timing was very good and we liked how that worked. And there are others where the timing just seemed to be horrible. When I started college, I lived my first year at home. We didn't live far from the campus, and I drove back and forth as a commuter. Well, when you do that, or at least when I did it, you did not have much of a sense of involvement in campus life or feeling a part. So that first year, I was just kind of commuting. But the second year, I moved into an apartment and began to get more involved in campus life. And one of the things I did that fall was to pledge a fraternity. Well, as a pledge, now I'm a sophomore. And there are guys who are sophomores who pledged the fall before who are now active members. And as active members, they impose certain obligations on pledges. In some ways and days that used to be called hazing. This illustration was not, but one of my sophomore colleagues, but an active member, determined that I should go to Patty's sorority, go to her at her sorority, I did not know her, and learn her sorority song, which I did. Well, as you know, it turned out that the pretty young blonde female that I met and learned that song from, not too many years later, became my wife. Had I pledged that first year, I would have been a pledge with the guy who sent me on that task. So he wouldn't have been able to do that. My timing in doing it the second year turned out to be far, far better. It was good timing for me. Obviously, we know the hand of God is involved in these issues of timing. But as I think with you about that, Ecclesiastes 3 begins with the well-known statement that there is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. Solomon goes on in that passage to illustrate what he means. Among the things he says is the phrase that there is a time to be silent and there is a time to speak. Isn't it hard to know for us when to be silent or when to wait and when to speak or be active? Well, that's very much what's wrapped up in the portion of the Ruth narrative that we'll look at today. Our author of this narrative has brought us to the end of the harvest season there in Bethlehem. Naomi, Ruth's mother-in-law, whom we've met, has seen that Boaz, this relative, has not made any move toward Ruth. She wants the best for Ruth, and she develops a plan for her daughter-in-law, who, as you remember, was a foreigner, a woman from Moab. She was a servant. She was at the lowest rung of the social ladder in Israel. And Naomi develops this plan for Ruth to marry an older, wealthy, respected businessman who we know as Boaz. Our first five verses this morning give us in chapter 3 the plan that Naomi had. Since they arrived in Bethlehem, from our prior studies, we've not seen much from Naomi. She's been rather passive. It's Ruth who's been the activist, if you remember. It was Ruth who said, "I want to go glean in the fields to get us grain." And she did, so the two of them could have food to eat. It was Ruth's idea. It was Ruth's labor throughout the entire harvest season as she went back day after day to get food for them. But contrary to how it may have appeared to us, Naomi has not sat idly by without observing the events that have taken place. Now we're about to see her emerge, and we'll see an aspect of her character and how concerned this woman, apparently old enough to be the mother of Ruth, she was the mother of Ruth's husband, we'll see how much concern she has for Ruth's welfare in the days ahead. And by the end now, of this harvest time, Naomi's got a plan for the future of Ruth. Look with me at verse 1. "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you?'" Just in that verse, there are a couple of quick observations we can make. Interestingly, Naomi calls Ruth her daughter, not daughter-in-law. Begins to speak of the closeness of these two women. She looks upon her now as a daughter. Second, Naomi said that she, Naomi, felt like she should seek security for Ruth. Ruth has been providing for Naomi, and now Naomi wants to provide for Ruth. Consider with me for just a moment the word the New American Standard translates as security there. If you look back at Ruth 1:9, that's the verse where Ruth is with the two daughters-in-law and is exhorting them to return home, and she says to them, "May the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." Well, the Hebrew word for rest in verse 9 of chapter 1 and the word for security here in verse 1 of chapter 3 are essentially the same word. They're very, very similar. They come out of the same root here. So rest there, security here, is found in having a husband for Ruth. She wanted, back in chapter 1, those women to return to their homes in Moab, where they would have a chance at marrying again. At that point, Naomi had no concept that marriage would be possible for Ruth or her other daughter-in-law in Bethlehem. Now, after weeks back in Bethlehem, and after observing Ruth's experience with Boaz during the early part of the harvest, Naomi's eyes have been opened to a plan. There's a solution here, she thinks, for the future of Ruth, and that's with Boaz. And she unfolds for us, you'll see it as we go through it, a dramatic and a very risky plan for Ruth. Let's look at verse 2 as this begins to unwind. "Now is not Boaz," she says, "our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight." So Naomi quickly makes it clear that it's Boaz that she has in mind for Ruth's future. And she says, "He tonight, that very day, is at the threshing floor, winnowing the grain. Now, a threshing floor was a place our mind's eyes would easily jump to something like a building, a barn, you know, where you've got a concrete floor or a hard surface. That's not the case then. A threshing floor would be some sort of place where there was a solid base, maybe a rock base, but it's going to be out on hopefully the side of a mountain where they can get some elevation. And the whole point to this, the winnowing, is to take something that looks like a pitchfork and take the stalks of the barley or the wheat and pitch them into the air and let the wind catch the chaff and blow the lighter chaff away and then let the grain settle onto the rock or the hard surface that would be called the threshing floor. I've got a picture, if it works out, that gives us a bit of an idea of what that looks like, just the tossing of that in the air and letting that heavier grain sift down. So Naomi's done some homework. I mean, she knows that Boaz that night will be out where they are winnowing the grain and doing this threshing operation. So she's tuned in. She hasn't just come up with this without getting details of the plan down and knowing where he would be. And she calls Boaz their kinsman. This is not the same word as the Goel word for kinsman redeemer that we saw earlier. This word means simply close relative. And it's out of that relationship that Naomi conceives that Boaz would be the logical one to fulfill her plan for Ruth. And she says, he is our close relative, Ruth, which is fully embracing her within the family. Now, we looked last time a little bit at Deuteronomy 25 and Leviticus 25. Leviticus 25 dealt with the kinsman redeemer who redeems property, if you remember that. Leviticus 25, on the other hand, dealt with the levirate marriage, where if the husband dies and he has a brother, then the brother was to take the wife of his deceased brother and have her as his wife to raise up an heir to his dead brother. As we look at this, neither of these circumstances are a real fit for us as we look at this narrative. Boaz was not a brother of Malon, who was the husband of Ruth. And he had no formal legal obligation to marry her and raise up an heir to either Malon or to Elimelech, his father and Naomi's husband. Ruth's focus here is that out of that close relationship, even without a legal obligation, that Boaz will respond to the need to provide what Ruth needed for the days ahead. I think it's an illustration of this loyal love, this hesed in the Hebrew word, that we see so much in Ruth. Here it's Naomi expressing it toward Ruth. Her plan's well thought out. Look at verse 3 as we begin to get more details. We know where Boaz is. Listen to how she instructs Ruth here. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. She says, look, Ruth, you've got to prepare. You've got to bathe. They did not bathe daily, as we tend to do. That was not in their routine. Body odor was an issue for them, as it can be for us. But it was an issue. And so she's saying, you need to bathe and you need to anoint yourself. This is with perfume. Nothing spiritual about this. There's something practical about it. You need to smell reasonably good. when you go down there. And then it says, and put on your best clothes. Both the NIV and the NASB pick up that translation. And just reading about this a little bit, I was interested to learn that it's the same word that was used of David. You remember David and his sinful, adulterous relationship with Bathsheba. And the first child born out of that sin died as a baby. David mourned that death, and in 2 Samuel 12:20, after he was told the baby had died, David arose from the ground, the text says, washed, anointed himself, and changed his clothes and came into the house of the Lord and worshiped. A very parallel thing to Ruth here. But here the word means he changed his clothes, not he put on his best clothes. So probably what she was saying was simply change your clothes, clean up, get clean, smelling decent, fresh clothes on, and go down. One of the writers I like a good bit in Ruth is Daniel Block, and he writes that it was possible, and I think there's certainly, this is speculation, maybe it's worth a little bit of a rabbit trail, but he said it's possible she had been wearing clothing that reflected her mourning over the death of her husband. And if she was attired in a way that spoke of her mourning, that may have explained why after that initial contact with Boaz, Boaz does not approach her after that through the rest of the harvest. Makes no contact with her whatsoever that the text gives us. So if that's correct, that would explain that and would also explain Naomi saying, if you're going to go get another husband, you need to change clothes. Not wear those any longer. And anyway, it was clear that she was to change. And she said, you're to go, but you stay out of sight, Ruth, until Boaz has finished eating and drinking there at where the grain is. And one of the things we need to know is that at that time, when they were threshing, winnowing out that grain, you know, and they're building their stockpile of grain, at that particular point, men stayed right there all night, kept animals out of the grain from coming in and messing that up. And secondly, it kept people from stealing it. So it was not an unusual thing for Boaz to be there. Verse 4, it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do. From the shadows, Ruth was to watch Boaz. She was to see when he finished eating and drinking and where he made his bed, probably at one end of the pile of grain or the other. Then, as he slept, she was to go, and the text says, uncover his feet. Now, there's a good bit written, I think a lot of it foolishly, about what this means. Uncovering the feet can be an idiom or a euphemistic phrase that speaks of a sexual relationship. Sort of like the idea of someone uncovering their father's nakedness, as we've seen in other Old Testament scripture. That's not the case here. This is simply Naomi saying to Ruth, not that you're go to have an illicit relationship with him at all. You're to go to him, lift his covering off his legs, and then lie down near him. It's an interesting picture that we get. And she says, then he will tell you what to do. But the context suggests nothing in the lives of these two godly people of anything untoward or inappropriate or immoral. Now, at that point, Naomi says, just do whatever he says, you know, this plan had a lot of risk for Ruth. At the point that Boaz would awaken during the night and see that he's partially uncovered and that a woman was lying nearby, there's no guarantee of how he'll respond to that. This is not normal. One possibility was that he would not be happy about Ruth's intrusion into that and being there close to him and could misunderstand what her motives were. I've read that it was not uncommon for prostitutes to seek out men or men to seek out prostitutes to come when they were guarding the grain at night in this kind of situation. How would Boaz perceive Ruth there? It's risky for her. If he thought her motives were impure and improper, then his rejection of her there would have a huge effect on how Ruth was seen not only by him, but also perceived in the community where we'll see she has a great reputation. Naomi was operating by faith and placing Ruth in a position that she would have to walk this out by faith. Faith in the response of Boaz and faith that God would produce the right response here to Ruth. Look at Ruth's remark to Naomi in verse 5. She said to her, "All that you have said, I will do." Ruth is all in, isn't she? You just got to respect that. There's a time to be silent and a time to speak. This is a time to speak or act, and Ruth says, "I'm all in. I'll do everything you have said." We had a mother figure here who saw a problem. She looked at the future. She saw Ruth out gleaning in the fields. How long would this be Ruth's station in life? It's a tough way to go, a dangerous thing to have to do, just to pick this one part of her life out. Naomi comes up with a plan that's not biblically mandated, but it fits in a scriptural scheme, if you will. It's close, what she has come up with. And she lays it out, and Ruth adopts it. And I think for us it illustrates, how do we deal with problems we encounter? We plan our way, and the Lord directs our steps. This is a good plan. It fits within the law and the custom that apparently had come out of the law. So they move forward with it. This was a time to speak. This was a time to act. Let's look at Ruth's execution of the plan as we see verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her. That's a summary for us. We know that she's going to carry it out. Now let's get the particulars as we start with verse 7. When Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was merry. He went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Just visualize this. Big pile of grain. Boaz goes to one end of it and stretches out. And she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. You get the picture there. Boaz ate and he drank and he was in a good mood. Some commentators talk about, well, was he drunk? What's it mean when he was merry? Well, the text doesn't say what he drank. It just says that he ate and he drank and he was in a good mood. Let's don't read into the text what's not there one way or the other. Just take the text for what it gives us. Now, Boaz is asleep at the end of the pile of grain, and Ruth, obviously, when he's sleeping, goes and uncovers his legs just as she had been told to do. Verse 8, it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. Now, obviously, time passed after she uncovered his feet and lay down. How well do you think Ruth was sleeping? I suspect that that woman's eyes were wide open, waiting to see what would happen. It's likely that the uncovering of the legs was designed at some point to cause this man to wake up. The New American Standard says he bent forward. He looks like, sounds like he set up to see what was going on. Hey, I'm cold, you know. And he looks, and there she is. The word bent forward means he twisted. He could have rolled over and had the same thing. But he sees a woman there, and he is startled. All that is normal and to be expected, as is his question in verse 9. He said, "Who are you? It's dark. Have I said this happened at night? Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maid." Immediately, she responds with who she is. This time with a very short description. "I'm your maid," or you can translate that, "I'm your servant." She doesn't put anything about Moab with that. She doesn't say she's beneath his maidservants. She just says, "I'm your servant. I'm here." Apparently, that makes it clear that there are no restrictions on Ruth to keep her from being able to go forward with what she says. And now look at the rest of the phrase, or the rest of the sentence. "I am Ruth, your maid, so spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." This is the punchline. When she says, "Spread your covering over me," that's an idiom for saying, "Marry me." Spread your wing over me. Cover me as a close relative. Marry me. Think of that for a second. Powerful statement here. Bold statement here. Risky statement here. But it's Ruth is building on what Boaz said about her in Ruth 2:12. If you look at that, back in verse 12 of chapter 2, talking about what he knew about her, Boaz said, "May the Lord reward your work and your wages be full from the Lord." In other words, may he bless you, the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. You've placed yourself under the Lord's provision by returning with Naomi here to Bethlehem. Now, Ruth turns that around and applies it and says, "Boaz, cover me. Give me the security and protection as my husband." You know, Naomi had taken her up to a point. She hadn't told her what Boaz would say. She just said, "Do what he said." Boaz said, "Who are you?" Ruth said, "I am Ruth, your servant." And then she adds, "And I'd like you to marry me." Wow, that's all Ruth. It was a time to speak. It was not a time to be silent. She spoke up. Let's see how Boaz responds. First he does with words, and then he will also act. Verse 10, "Then he said, 'May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after young men, whether poor or rich.'" Now, this is a man awakened in the middle of the night by a woman at his feet that he did not expect and did not recognize. And she pops up after saying her name with a proposal of marriage. It's very unusual. Daniel Block writes that it's evidence of the hidden hand of God working in the lives of his people here and prompting them to action. Boaz first seeks the blessing of God upon Ruth, and he calls her again his daughter, a term of affection, of care, of his interest in caring for her. The Lord had blessed Boaz through Ruth, and he was thrilled that she, as a young woman, would want to marry him at his age and stage in life. He stated that her hesed, her loyal love then, was even greater than what she had shown because she had passed on the opportunity to marry the young and virile. Rich or poor, didn't matter. She passed on that opportunity. So when he says, the hesed you've shown now, who was that hesed shown toward? It almost seems at first that he's saying, the loyal love you've shown now toward me is even greater than what you expressed toward Naomi, because you've chosen me over the young and virile guys that would be eligible here in Bethlehem. But I don't think that's it, because he so respected what she had done with Naomi that I'd be a bit surprised that he would say this was even greater than what she had done for Naomi. I suspect that what Boaz is referring to here is that by Ruth's decision to ask to marry him as a close relative and passing on all other opportunities, she is showing an even greater act of loyal love to Naomi than what she had previously done for her. This was, from Ruth's standpoint, not just about Ruth, but Ruth would see it as caring for Naomi. For what did Ruth say to Naomi? Where you go, I'll go. I'll never leave you. Your people will be my people. Where you die, I'll be buried too. I think she's got Naomi in mind here. Now look at what else Boaz says in verse 11. Now, my daughter, do not fear. What great words from this man. Looking at her there in this dark moment at night, just the two of them, and he says, don't be anxious. Don't be afraid. He comforts her, and he says, I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence. He says, I'll do what you ask. We know the kind of person you are. Now think about this. Think about Ruth coming as a foreigner to an Israelite, as one at the lowest level on the social scale in Bethlehem to the man who is at the highest. Coming as a female to a male to propose marriage. This has the picture through the world's eyes of something that absolutely will not happen. It would not work. It's too far-fetched. She's young, he's old. This just does not work. That's not how Boaz sees it, though. He doesn't look at it through worldly eyes. Boaz has looked into the character of Ruth, and he knows the character of Ruth by her reputation and what she has done. And you know, the same word he uses for her as a woman of excellence is the word that was used of him in chapter 2, verse 1. Now, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. We read that and think, ah, he's a He's a wealthy farmer. But the words great wealth there, as we looked at before, carry much more meaning than financial. They speak of his character. Same words used here of Ruth in verse 11 by Boaz. A woman of excellence. These were two people of excellent character. In Ruth, Boaz sees that he's met his match. She is not unequal to him. This is a woman of character that is every bit equal to this man. That's what he sees in her. He sees beyond all the distinctions that we might be quick to point out. But the next words he utters probably caused her heart to stop. After this great response, now listen to what he says in verse 12. Now it is true, I am a close relative, but, however, there is a relative closer than I. She's gone through all this, and Boaz says, there's someone closer than I. Listen to how he goes on. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. Little curve came here that we weren't looking for. I am close, but you need to know, Ruth, there's another closer than I. And in the morning, if he'll agree to redeem you, then good. You can be his wife. You notice four times in that verse 13, he's talking about redeeming Ruth. When we get to chapter 4, we start off with the whole issue being the redemption of property. This is not about the redemption of property when Boaz goes to work the next day. It's about redeeming Ruth. He wants that to happen. But as badly as Boaz wants her for his wife, he's put on the brakes because this custom that's developed under the law of the levirate marriage, he looks at and says, there's another who has a claim that is superior to mine, and I will wait. There's a time to speak, and there's a time to wait. And here he pulls back, being on the verge of being able to marry this young woman who is interested in him. Boaz is willing to say, I'll stop. I want to do the right thing, but I want to do the right thing the right way. And the right way is to give this other gentleman the first right to redeem. That's faith. That's trusting that if the Lord will work it out, he'll work it out. I'll leave it up to him. That's why it's preposterous to suggest there was anything immoral that was going on there on the floor of the threshing area that night between these two. These are godly people, and Boaz brings that out, and it teaches us, I think, that there are times where we need to stop and be sure that though we're doing the right thing, we're also doing it the right way. And if that means we have to slow down and open our hands and release our grip on what it is we so desperately think we want and have, then we need to be willing to do that and let God bring the results. Now, Boaz wants to do something else that, as morning comes, look with me at verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning and rose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Now, Boaz is saying, look, sleep, but let's get up and get you going in the morning before anyone else knows you were here. Why? So there won't be speculation about what was going on. These are godly people here. And Boaz says, let me protect you and your reputation. Others don't need to know that you have come in the night to me. So lie here until morning. And so she did. And then he said, give me the cloak that is on you and hold it. So she held it, and he measured 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. Then she went to the city. The text literally says that he measured 6 of barley. We don't know exactly how much. Maybe it's just 6 scoops. But he said, take your shawl off, your cloak, and hold it out. And he dumped the barley in it and said, take this with you as you go back. He doesn't want her to go back empty-handed. This is a gracious, giving man. And he sent her back to Naomi with grain as morning, the next morning came. We conclude with her report back to Naomi. Verse 16, when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did it go, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done for her. She said, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said, do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed. A little more insight. Boaz said, I don't want you going back to Naomi empty-handed. Maybe Boaz perceived that Naomi was the mastermind of what had happened that night. But he wanted her cared for. He wanted her honored, and he sent her the grain. Verse 18, then she said, this is Naomi speaking, wait, my daughter, until you know how the matter turns out, for this man will not rest until he has settled it today. You know, we started chapter 3 with a plan of action. We end chapter 3 with the same woman who spoke, it's time to act, saying, now it's time to wait. It's a time to be silent. There's a time to speak. This was a time to hold up and wait and see what happened. She knew Boaz well enough to know, and judging from his response, he would be on this first thing the next day. And Ruth and she would just need to wait and see how it unveiled. As we close, let me consider with you a couple questions about this narrative. Why do you think Ruth was willing to take all the risk that attended a middle-of-the-night proposal of marriage to Boaz out at this threshing floor? It was high risk. There's no indication that she felt any desperate need for a husband. We've not seen that in the narrative. But was her need for security so great that she would even risk ruining her reputation? She had served so faithfully, and she'd not complained about any lack of security. Naomi was the one who was worried about Ruth's future. I would suggest to you that at the core of the motivation Ruth had to take on this risky scheme was her loyal love for Naomi. It's not just that it was Naomi's idea, but whatever was security for Ruth would be security for Naomi. If Boaz married her, Ruth knew Naomi would be covered. She would be provided for. I'd say her loyal love is displayed again here as she accepted the risks and moved forward. There would be a benefit for her, of course, but she also saw the benefit for Naomi. Second question, why was Boaz willing to agree to marry Ruth if the closer relative did not? Boaz, we've been told, is an older guy, probably old enough to be her father. He hasn't needed a wife. He's come this far. He's, in the eyes of those who would look upon him, successful. He's at a completely different social level. But again, Boaz did not look at this with worldly eyes. I say he had spiritual insight. And he saw the character of this woman. And that view absolutely transcended any economic issue, any ethnic issue, any social issue. What mattered to him was Ruth was a woman who shared the values that he had, and it's obvious that he considers it a real privilege to be able to marry her if that's what happens. What we've witnessed in this narrative is not two people who fall in love. Not at all. This is a great marriage that's taking place here. But it's the coming together of two godly people whose loyal love for others, in Ruth's case, Naomi, and in Boaz's case, Ruth, will be blessed by God in ways they cannot expect or even envision. There were not bells and whistles going off with Ruth and Boaz. This is, if you will, an arranged marriage. This is, if you will, more particularly, a divinely arranged marriage. This is one in which the two involved seem to have a sense of when to be silent and when to speak. I thought, as Don led us in remembering Christ at the table, when we think of his sacrifice, all that God put him through to accomplish what he intended for Jesus to do, and that was to free us from the clutch of sin. Why do we doubt that he is concerned about our lives? He is concerned about the details of our lives. He will act to fulfill his purposes in your life and in mine. It may not be according to the schedule that we would like to see happen. There may be purposes that we had no idea would come to fruition. But Boaz and Ruth are evidence that God is at work. He's accomplishing his purposes in their lives. And as they allow him to do so, the blessing is there for them. May it be for us as well. Let's pray. Father, how we love the illustrations your word gives us of life. We can feel the anxiety, we can feel the emotion, we can feel the pathos of what happened with Ruth and Boaz that night where the threshing floor was. What an unusual place and an unusual way to bring people together. But we know, God, you are not limited as we are. Thank you for that. Thank you that you show us how much you care for us. And we see that most clearly in the death of Christ. May we understand how that impacts how we live today in the confidence that you are working out your purpose in our lives. Thank you for Jesus' sake.